to the question and answer session. We did receive a number of questions, so we won't have time to run through all of these during our question and answer period, but we will provide answers in writing to all the questions submitted. We'll be posting those on the website, and also once we've collected answers from all the presenters, we will email those out. And I think Lauren mentioned that you should expect to see an email from her. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Lauren to ask some of the questions that we did receive.
Thank you, Neelam. I'm going to lead off with a couple questions for you and then get into the case studies of some of the questions we received. The first question we have for you, in terms of the impact to water quality, what is the connection between the urban heat island and increased runoff?
Sure. I'd be happy to answer that. One of the first connections between heat island mitigation and water quality is that the cause of oftentimes increased stormwater, and this is not necessarily always the case because the sewer systems for transporting stormwater are clearly a factor. But when it comes to what's on the surface, the roofs and pavements, traditional roofs and pavements that, or I should say, impervious roofs and pavements actually contribute to stormwater runoff, the actual quantity of stormwater runoff. And a solution to both cooling and to reducing stormwater are strategies such as increasing vegetation and tree canopy. And then that also overlaps to the green roof mitigation strategy. When we talk about increasing vegetation, that can be open space, like open green space. And so that is one of the techniques for reducing stormwater through low-impact development. So essentially the connection is that a lot of the mitigation strategies that can potentially cool communities can also help reduce stormwater runoff. And the second connection is that the higher surface temperatures increase the temperature of the runoff that's going into our waterways. And if we're able to cool those surfaces, we would be able to, in some ways, reduce the temperature of the runoff. And that would affect water quality as well. There's been some recent studies that have come out showing that the higher water temperatures are actually affecting aquatic life. And this is part of a solution. Reducing the heat island effect is part of a solution that can decrease water temperatures.
Great. Thanks, Neelam. And then the second question for you, are there any federal regulations for urban heat islands? And if not, what are the reasons for leaving urban heat island measures up to individuals or even local governments rather than addressing it on a federal level?
Great question. So there are no federal regulations specifically for urban heat island impacts, or excuse me, the urban heat island effect, but there are some regulations that address some of the impacts of the urban heat island effect. For example, funding that can come out of the U.S. Forest Service, funding that for specific programs that come out of the U.S. Forest Service actually have an element as one of the many co-benefits that are included, there's an element to reduce the heat island effect. So that would be an example of how some federal regulations might address the heat island effect, but there is nothing specifically for the heat island effect. And the reason for leaving it up to individuals and, you know, state governments or local governments is because the conditions in each community are very specific, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution. We can't go out and say that everybody should plant X, Y, like plant X species of trees to get this amount of cooling in your community. At a national level, we can't provide that type of solution or even recommend something, and that is because each community is so specific and unique. And so it's important to do local analysis to find the best combination of strategies for your community.
Great. Thank you, Neelam. We're going to move on to a couple of questions for Brian Stone from Georgia Tech University. And Brian, the first question, to what extent is the heat island effect increasing estimates of the increase in world temperatures? This is given that many measuring stations are in urban areas.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it kind of highlights the reason why there is a significant emphasis on global temperature, and often there's not as much of an emphasis on urban temperatures, in that if you're interested in measuring how rapidly the planet as a whole is warming, then you're going to be using these surface weather stations around the planet. And most of those stations are in or close to cities. And so because cities have their own warming mechanism, relying on too many of those urban stations will bias your global temperature record. And so the way that's dealt with is that these global databases that are looking at annual temperature change are statistically adjusting the urban weather stations. And so that is, you know, essentially obscuring what's happening in cities. And if you're interested in global scale temperature change, that's not such a big deal because cities only constitute 2 to 3% of the global land surface. So while cities are a small percentage of the planet as a whole, in terms of geography, they account for most of the inhabitants on the planet. And so they're very important in the sense of the places people live and the places where we're generating lots of greenhouse gases. And so what we do is kind of exactly the opposite of what the global climate scientists are doing. We look just at the urban weather stations. We don't statistically adjust them. And then we compare their warming trends to what's happening either right outside of them or globally to see how much more rapidly they're warming. And so that was the idea of the amplification rate that I was talking about. And so most large cities in the U.S. are amplifying background warming rates by about 100%. And so that's how we control for the global versus the urban trends.
Great, thank you. And then related to that question, a participant asked, in your book, Houston is showing as cooling while Atlanta is getting hotter. What are your thoughts on this trend that you're seeing?
I'd have to look at the actual graphics. So we have a number of graphics in the book where we're talking either about the increase in heat waves, the number of heat wave days, or we're talking about the increase in the heat island. And from my memory, I'm not sure which one Houston is found to be cooling. But just in general, when we look across 50 cities, just as we look across thousands of weather stations across the planet, not all of those weather stations are showing a warming trend. And that's why you get into some debates, particularly with those who are skeptical of climate change in general. There's a fair amount of cherry picking that goes on to just pick these cooling stations. There are lots of microclimatic or regional climate anomalies or conditions that can result in a trend that's counter to the overall trend. And so the reason we look at a large number of cities and we look at a large number of years, I mean, we have data for every day over 50 years, is to get a sense of what is the overall dominant trend as opposed to these outliers. But I wish I could speak specifically to Houston for the question. I know I can't interact directly with the person who's asking the question, but like I mentioned before, if it's the heat island trends, we do tend to find that there are some regions where heat islands are not growing. And one of the reasons we see that, it doesn't mean that the city is not warming over time, but in some regions you actually have rural areas that are warming at the same pace as the urban area. And that typically happens in cities where you don't have rapid land cover change. But I can't speak directly to Houston because I don't actually have the data in front of me. I'm sorry about that.
Brian, we can actually follow up with that.
I'd love to do that. I can give you a better answer to that particular case.
Yeah, and we can follow up with that in writing as well.
Great.
Great. Thank you, Brian. And then we're going to move into some questions for Brendan Reed from Chula Vista. And Brendan, the first question that we received, a participant was curious what the science was that informed the working group. Were there any studies done on specific conditions in Chula Vista, for example, related to the city's specific energy balance?
Sure. Well, we were very fortunate. I sort of mentioned it, but in our region, there's the San Diego Foundation, and it's a community foundation. And they created a study called Focus 2050 that looked at climate change impacts to our region in the year 2050. And it was inspired by a similar study done up in Kings County. In Washington, and they worked. We're also very fortunate. We have a lot of local research institutions like Scripps Institute of Oceanography, a number of higher education institutions. So they worked to convene a bunch of technical advisors, again, synthesize and summarize that information. And so we had a great starting point because literally for all of those sort of impact areas that you would imagine for climate adaptation, there was already some results of what the new norm looks like in 2050 for us.
Thanks, Brendan. And then the next question we had, do you expect developers to resist requirements to comply with the new standards? How will you get them to buy in? And if this is required, how to comply with the new standards, will the cost be passed on to the consumer? And how will this affect new home starts?
Okay, there's a lot of questions there. So I guess I'll first answer it more broadly. When we had done a similar process and focused on climate mitigation, a stakeholder process, maybe 5 years ago when I started at the city, we really didn't have enough sort of business representatives and developers on the stakeholder group, and that definitely caused trouble or problems later on. So this time around with the climate adaptation strategies, like I said, there were business representatives, both small and large businesses. There was developers that participated. So, it was definitely like a no surprises environment. And I think that has helped these kind of initiatives get political support and also, to get support in the development community. I think we're in our region, we tend to be known as a little bit, out ahead and sort of progressive on environmental issues, sustainability issues, especially around sort of environmental justice. So I think they've gotten used to that a little bit, but we are very sensitive to sort of those things about the market and housing prices, et cetera. But for example, the cool roofs, really we found that in most cases, they're already installing what we call a tier one cool roof. And I mean, really the extra cost for a tier two is minimal. It is a balancing act.
All right, thanks. And then the next question is related to the cool pavement study.
Sure.
Chula Vista did, and this participant was curious when the cool pavement study will be released to the public, and also if it included a look at how the different paving technologies would hold up under high heat.
It's in an administrative draft form now, but we do hope for the study to be finalized. I think it's by the end of October that we're shooting for at this point. We did have a limited budget for this, so in a lot of instances, it's more of a qualitative analysis of the different applications and the different technologies. But it did look at sort of the full spectrum of what you would kind of want to consider when you're picking a pavement material. How well it does in addressing urban heat island or sustainability issues, but also the costs, the longevity, the maintenance requirements, where it's been done elsewhere, its availability on the market, which is actually a bigger thing a lot of times, if it's even available locally. So it is robust in that regard.
Great. Thanks, Brendan. We received a number of other questions for you, but we'll be following up with these questions via email as we're getting a little bit close on time. Matt Grubasich from the Texas Tree Foundation, we had a number of questions for you. One was related to the dollar benefit calculations that you performed. How did you estimate the benefit of tree plantings? I think on one of your slides you had $102 million per year after 40 years. Did you use the iTree model, and do you measure and verify these savings?
Yeah, we did use the iTree model, and we're in the process. We've done a numerous U4 studies throughout the Dallas-Fort Worth area, so we were able to kind of even take those numbers and kind of even more centralize them for the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And we haven't started to look at the what benefits these trees are provided that we just planted. This program is just a couple years old, so we're only about 2 or 3 years into the planting process. But that's something that we're developing now, is how do we go back and look at this, and are we really making a difference, and are those benefits really what they say they are? So hopefully I'll have something more in about 5 years on that one.
And thank you. And where did your temperature data come from? Is there a publicly available database where you collected your data?
The temperature data was done through HARC, the Houston Advanced Research Center, through the grant, through EPA, through the Sustainable Skylines Initiative. And you can find the report on that online. You can just go to the Dallas City website, and you can find it there, or their Office of Environmental Quality. And the entire report is on there. But that was a one-time snapshot of temperature values taken, I think, in 2004. So that's something else that we would plan on doing probably in the next probably 5 to 6 years, is redoing that study to see if we're having an effect in those areas.
Great, thank you. And then the next question for you, when planting trees, do you take into consideration the overhead electric power distribution system?
Always. And as I had mentioned in the report, that we were actually able to get the power line information from the power company, and so that was included in that roadmap. And, you know, so there's, and of those 1.8 million locations, not one of them is underneath the power line, or at least ones that we had GIS data for. And any project that we do, you know, obviously you have to go and look at the site, and that's always the first thing that we take into consideration is overhead power lines.
And final question for you, is Texas following a native tree policy?
Yeah, we plant, we recommend all native trees or well-adapted. As hot and dry as it is here, our species palette is pretty limited. And so to keep from getting too much of a monoculture, for instance, we have way too many red oaks and live oaks down here, so we don't plant a lot of those anymore. But everything that we do plant is either adapted or native.
Great, thank you. And we'll now move on to Norman Mariah from Austin, from Austin Energy. Norman, the first question for you, in your slides you mentioned TPO as an acronym you used. What is TPO and a ballasted roof?
That would be, hold on a second. I'm trying to remember what the acronym for TPO. The ballasted roof is where you have a flat built-up roof, and then you put rocks or pebbles or gravel on that, which essentially ballasts it so that it keeps the weight down on there. And the advantage of that rocks is that they're at least a little bit more reflective than the black rubber roof. The TPO is just it's a type of membrane that would be put on there, which would have that insulation as well as that reflective surface. For some reason, I can't quite remember what the acronym, but we can reply that with the questions that will be sent in. Actually, it means thermoplastic polyolefin. So TPO is thermoplastic polyolefin.
Great, thank you. The next question for you, is there any way to treat asphalt roof tiles as part of a cool roof program? And this is short of replacing the tiles that you're aware of.
Yes, it is. That was the other option. Instead of the TPO, you could go with a spray paint. The paints do not last as long, but you actually achieve initial much cooler temperatures. And, of course, if you're diligent, you can always come back a year or two later or a couple years later, since the cost is very low.
Great. Thank you for that. And, Neelam, do you want to wrap up?
Yes, that'd be great. Thanks, Lauren. And I want to thank the audience for all their questions. There's a lot of interest in this area, so we will be sure to follow up with written answers to your questions. There will also be a transcript of this call available for those of you that could not stay on the whole time. And we do encourage you to fill out the optional feedback questions that will be provided when you exit this. So once again, thank you to all the participants, and to all of the presenters in helping us motivate our communities to take action to reduce the heat island effect. Take care.